And now to Arlie Helm and this week's Best of Health.
Your host is Arlie Helm, and we have with us today Dr. Patrick McGowan, who is doing his postdoctoral research project at McGill University, and he has recently released the results of a study on childhood trauma and its lifelong effect on genes and the brain. Now, McGill University is in Canada. How long have you been up in Canada, Dr. McGowan?
I've been here about going on 4 years now.
And where did you get to Canada from? Where did you do your doctorate?
I did my doctorate at Duke University.
At Duke University. So you went from warm to cold.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah.
And what interested you in looking at potential permanent effects on the brain of childhood abuse?
Well, this is a really fascinating area of research for people who are interested in the brain to understand the interaction between the environment and genetics. And it's only recently we've been able to develop the tools to start doing this. So the lab that I'm working in here is famous for its studies of rat behavior and the gene and environment interactions in between a rat mom's behavior and the behavior of the rat pup. So we decided that what we would try to do is to try to see if similar processes are happening in the brains of people.
So you translated your previous results from rats to now work looking at humans.
That's right. And specifically, we were interested in child abuse because we were interested in a model of understanding how serious events in childhood that have a long-term impact on people's responses to stress can affect their later adult life. And so suicide victims are a good example of that because a lot of suicide victims have a history of childhood abuse in their past.
Yeah, and I had heard actually for the last 10 years from different friends of mine in the psychology area that they felt that there was some type of hardwiring that had changed in children who had experienced abuse on an ongoing basis during their childhood. When they reached adulthood, they felt that perhaps some of the SSRIs were responsible for helping people deal with that type of wiring problem.
Right. So it's very common for people who've had a history of childhood abuse to develop mental illness later on, and that includes depression. So we were really interested in the effects, not only the effects later on the behaviors that like depression, but also we were interested in various forms of mental illness that could be caused by early childhood abuse. So the individuals that we selected for our study were basically all abused in childhood, but we also had a separate group of people who had committed suicide that didn't have that history of childhood abuse to compare them to.
So basically you were looking at four groups of people: a group of people who was abused during childhood and committed suicide, a group of people who was abused during childhood and did not commit suicide?
That's the only group, unfortunately, that's the only group that we didn't have.
Okay.
So we have a brain bank here where I am in the province of Quebec that we get donations to. And we take what we can get. We have to get, obviously, the consent of the next of kin. We have a dedicated center here for studying suicide research.
So. Okay. And this type of research that you're looking at has to be done post-mortem, is that correct?
That's right, because we're looking in the human brain directly.
Okay.
It's impossible to do this in any other way.
So that you had the suicide brain bank, and you were able to go back and investigate, looking at particular changes that you were wanting to see, whether they had expressed themselves in the brains of these young people that had committed suicide when you knew that they had a background of abuse, and then others that you knew they had no background of abuse?
Yes, that's right. We use a method called psychological autopsy,
mm-hmm.
and we go back and look at all the information we can get. They do extensive interviews with family members, looking at medical records, any kind of information that could give them an indication of what happened in their past. So in the case of the individuals we were looking at, we were sure that they were all abused or that they were all not abused in their past. past, as sure as we can be.
So you did a pretty thorough background check and psychological history of all the brains of all the human beings who had once had these brains that you were taking apart and looking at, and you could feel fairly confident that you had divided them into the abused and non-abused groups.
Right.
And by abused we mean on an ongoing basis, a sort of chronic situation, not just that one time the parent flipped out and did something that they were ashamed of forever, but as an ongoing basis they were.
No, that's right. It was you know, very severe abuse. We're talking about things that, you know, do leave more than just emotional scars, but, you know, physical scars in many cases, or severe neglect. And these are ratings that are, you know, that this is one end of a spectrum. It's as extreme as it gets, really.
Yeah, and you used pretty standard for the psychological field of study definitions of abuse and neglect and so forth. Okay, so let's get down to what you found out. What part of the brain were you looking at?
Well, we chose to look at a part of the brain called the hippocampus, and the hippocampus is a structure that sits kind of in the middle of the brain. It's known to be very important for learning and memory, and it is one that we know the most about in terms of all of the different parts of the brain. And also that, you know, one thing that was important for us is that we're comparing across species because we want to see, you know, that we're looking at the stress pathway, and we know that this particular structure is a bottleneck for the stress pathway. So whatever it does, you know, has effects downstream on stress responses. So that's what we focused on.
And why is that? The hippocampus, let's see. Tell me the relationship between the hippocampus and glucocorticoids.
Well, glucocorticoid, so there are receptors for glucocorticoids in the hippocampus. So these are I don't know how to describe it. So these are molecules that sit in the cells and wait for signals that come from the adrenal glands. So the adrenal glands will release cortisol, which is like a stress hormone, and these are like stress sensors that sit in the hippocampus. And they, when they meet cortisol, they shut down more production of cortisol. So they're kind of dampening this stress response. Downstream, they send more signals from the brain downstream to shut down this upsurge of cortisol, because cortisol is involved in, you may have heard of the fight and flight response. Mm-hmm. So it gets your body ready for an attack or to run away. And the problem is that when you have this chronic upsurge in cortisol, you have damage to the brain. And so what you want to do is you want to be able to shut down that response when the situation doesn't call for fight or flight. And the problem is, when you have less glucocorticoid receptors, you don't have the ability to sense the cortisol coming in, and so you don't have the ability to stop more production of cortisol and all its disastrous effects that of long-term exposure to cortisol.
So long-term exposure to cortisol, in a nutshell, cortisol, which is being produced other places than the brain, right? The hypothalamus, pituitary, the adrenals?
Cortisol is released from the adrenal gland through other mechanisms.
Okay.
From the hypothalamus directing this. It's like a master switch.
Okay, and then it's going to the brain, and here's where it's getting picked up, in this hippocampus. And so the long-term effects of stress over and over and over, badly neglecting a child, hurting a child, abusing a child over and over, what happens?
Well, this has effects immediately, obviously, when the child is exposed, is being abused. But not only that, what we think is happening is that it's leaving an imprint on the ability of the genes to make more of this receptor. So what we think is happening is that this childhood abuse is leading to the gene to be shut down to a greater extent than when an individual has a happy childhood. And so what that means is that later on the individual will have less ability to shut down his stress response to things that maybe people with happy childhoods wouldn't normally be stressed by. So it's really, in a sense, their resiliency to stress that's being affected.
So later on, perhaps in adulthood, they may react more strongly or more negatively to stress than someone with a happy childhood would have done.
That's right, and the clinical literature bears this out. So it's well known that people who are victims of abuse, not all, but they tend to not have as great an ability to appropriately respond to stressful events.
So everything seems like a world-ending tragedy.
Uh-huh.
But that's how it feels to them.
That's one way to put it, yeah.
Yeah. So childhood adversities altering the way that they're going to respond to stress through the rest of their life, and you are actually finding biochemical markers for this in the brain.
That's right. This is the part that makes it really interesting to the biochemists, is that before, the idea was that you had your genes and then you had your environment, and the two didn't really meet. The genes are fixed, and whatever you're born with, you have the rest of your life. What we're saying here is that we're studying a phenomenon that we call an epigenetic phenomenon, meaning beyond genetics, literally. But what is happening is that the environment has a way to mark the genes so that later on, when it's producing, so the genes, when they're producing the glucocorticoid receptor in this case, it knows how much to make or how little to make of it on an ongoing basis. And in this case, what we're saying is that we found that this biochemical marker, this marker is called methylation, is present to a greater extent on the gene for the stress response in victims of childhood abuse who later committed suicide.
So you find when you look at the gene for stress response, there's been more changes, and you can track the footprints of those changes by methylations. You can see how many methylations there have been.
That's right.
And you can say, wow, this person, there were a lot of alterations made after this person was born.
Yes, and we think that these kind of marks are stable, but we also think from work in animals in the lab that these things are potentially reversible, and that's what makes this so exciting, is that the hope is that through either behavioral interventions or drugs, perhaps, and certain medications, we might one day be able to figure out how to reverse these changes.
Would perhaps some of these SSRIs cause a new growth and that would sort of smooth over these methylations?
It's
be possible?
It's very possible, because SSRIs are known to regulate serotonin, which is very important in mood in the brain, and it turns out that serotonin is upstream of this pathway that controls the glucocorticoid receptor. So it'd be fascinating to try to now look at that question as to whether SSRIs can have a downstream effect on this stress gene to permanently alter these marks if they're there.
So it goes much deeper than simply learning to be unhappy and then learning to be happy, or being taught to be unhappy and learning to be unhappy, because this is more like a reflex. This is at the level of the cell and how the cell is going to be programmed to respond. It's not so much
That's
a
right.
choice.
That's right. These things are not entirely inflexible. So, some of the most powerful things that can change the way people, people's happiness are behavioral things, things that they learn rather than drugs. Because drugs, as good as they are, they tend to be somewhat nonspecific, and they tend to act in various ways that we still don't understand. There are very documented effects of cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, that in individuals that have had a history of violence in their past, that can help them to overcome these things.
I don't know, and forgive me for not knowing this, but I don't know if Elie Wiesel is still living or not. He was one of the more famous of the survivors of the Nazi concentration camps, who survived it as a child and then grew up and wrote about it.
Right.
And specifically the focus of his writing was forgive and go on and how to have a happy life. In a nutshell, I'm doing an awful abbreviated Cliff's Notes of his life. But would you be particularly interested in being able to examine brains of people that went through the worst kind of abuse and yet seem to somehow learn to respond as if they hadn't been that badly abused?
Yes, that's a fascinating area, and it's you know, now is the time to really look at this as far as we can, because people who, for example, have survived the Holocaust, as you say, are not going to be with us for that much longer, and so there are other examples as well of individuals who've gone through things that are, they have maybe post-traumatic stress disorder from as soldiers in Iraq, for example, or a lot of those, and these are fascinating subjects to study. Why does someone, does one person in the same situation would get post-traumatic stress disorder and another one not, or someone who's gone through the Holocaust survive and actually use that as a way to learn to be happy in their life compared to someone who was not able to cope with it?
What conclusions can you draw from the research that you've done, this most recent article, which was picked up by the BBC, and that's how I found out about it, on your epigenetic regulation of this glucocorticoid receptor. So, in a nutshell, what are your conclusions?
Well, I think what this shows is that what we have shown is that people who have been severely abused or neglected in early childhood, there are permanent changes in the brain that in the stress response that really show a mechanism for why it would be that they might not be as resistant to stress later in life. I think that's the first thing that's quite important from our study. It shows that the human brain, in this sense, is responding in a way that's like a lot of other mammals that we already know about, like the rat has a very similar mechanism. So it offers the ability to study this phenomenon in animals and to understand perhaps what might work and what might not work in terms of drug therapy in humans.
For healing
this, right, exactly. So it goes beyond knowing the outcomes of for people to actually starting to be able to understand why this happens in the brain.
What about prevention? What about on the prevention side? Now, I would imagine that most adult abusers see themselves more as victims than abusers. Do you get into that at all, and the prevention side of it? Are you speaking to any groups to encourage more work in that area?
Yeah, this is really important. We'll have to do a lot more work collaboratively with social scientists and behavioral scientists in the future. My background is really in psychology, but I was trained here as a molecular biologist to look at these activities in the brain. But I think it's no longer the case that we can stay in our isolated fields and one will work on, just the mechanisms at the molecular level, and others will work at the behavioral level. I think we need to work with people now who are doing interventions in early childhood, for example, to look at outcomes and to know which interventions are effective and which are not, and then really be able to develop markers for these kinds of changes that we see in the brain, in the blood, so that we can go now and see who is at risk for these long-term effects.
So if a child were to, if you were to suspect a child was being abused, now it would be possible for the child's doctor to get a blood sample and look for the same kind of markers, look for markers in the same kind of molecular way that you have found markers in the brain that might substantiate the child's story or substantiate everyone's fears.
Well, that's a bit of a gray area because, it's not the case that all of the subjects that we looked at that had child abuse all had the same markers, and the ones that didn't. There are exceptions, and those exceptions could be very important for people. I guess more what we're talking about here is, and also, the fact is that we don't have good markers now yet. This is the very first of what will surely be a very active area of research to identify these biomarkers. But currently, not very much is known about this. And so I think there's a lot of work to do.
So up until this point, what we have known is that psychopathologies and suicide and so forth definitely have been associated or caused by a history of childhood abuse. Would you say there's a causative link there between a history of childhood abuse and subsequent suicides in many people?
Well, no, we can never say that it's causative. We can only say that it's correlative.
Okay.
The one disadvantage, you know, there are disadvantages to this. We looked at a small group of subjects, and when you're talking about human studies, you're not being able to prove cause and effect. You're looking at the relationship between two things occurring, but it doesn't mean that one is causing the other.
Okay. And where does it end? Say that a person has these epigenetic changes as a result of being abused as a child. Do they then pass them on to their own children?
Well, that's a fascinating topic as well. I mean, so with genetics, it's very straightforward. If you have a gene that confers an additional risk for, say, breast cancer, you will likely pass that on, if it's a dominant form of the gene, to the next generation. But when we talk about changes that are epigenetic, the methylation markings of the genes, these things are not passed on directly through the genome, because the changes that occur are very dependent upon which area of the body you're looking at. So the ones in the brain, these have to be reestablished for every individual, every time an individual grows up. But the way that they can be is through the behavior of the parent. So if the behavior of the parent was the same as his parent, then this is a mechanism for how it can propagate across generations. And we see evidence for that in humans as well as in animals.
So assuming, and I know this is such a big assumption, but assuming that we could somehow have an intervention that allowed that person who had been abused as a child to almost start over fresh as an adult, not repeating those behaviors, when they had their own child, then the child of this person does actually get a fresh start.
That's right, exactly. And that's I think, what is the hope of what we're seeing in this.
And what about, have suicides been increasing, decreasing, or maintaining as sort of steady numbers recently?
Recently, suicide rates have been going up. It is a major health problem in every country. And the reasons that people commit suicide vary. When you have periods of economic strife, as we are in right now, you see a spike in suicide rates. But it continues to be and has been a major health issue.
And I know that you first studied rats and looked at maltreatment of rats and you looked at methylations on the rats.
That's right.
Okay, hippocampus. Okay, so, if we don't mess around with rats, do they actually? I have two questions. Do they abuse their young? And do they commit suicide?
No, that's a good question. I mean, rats don't commit suicide. What we're studying when we study animals usually is that we're studying an animal in a cage. And so a cage is not like a natural environment. So one big caveat to these studies in animals has always been that, of course, the animals are not in the natural environment, so we're studying something like a prison population, for example. But we don't know much about the wild rat in terms of how its epigenetic markings are. The rats do not commit suicide. There's no good, what we did is the reason that we use suicide is because we wanted to have a clear idea of the outcome of these early childhood abuse on the individuals that we were looking at. So it gives us a very extreme phenotype to look at. But presumably, not just in suicide, but in other cases, you would see similar markings on this gene.
So we were actually, as human beings, able to abuse rats, find methylations, and then find children who had definitely been abused and killed themselves, and find methylations there as well.
Well, in the rats, looking at actually a natural variation in behavior that occurs, in normal laboratory rats. So it's not a question of them abusing or not abusing their young, but they do show very big, stark differences in terms of how much attention they pay to their young.
Okay.
And that just occurs for reasons that that we don't fully understand. Many of them could be epigenetic. But some animals, and we look at the tails of the distribution, so we look at the bottom 15% who don't So what rats do is they lick and they groom their pups, and that keeps them happy. So there are the bottom 15% that don't do very much of that at all, and then the top 15% that just lick and groom their pups like crazy. And when you compare the two, you see these very different differences in methylation in this gene that's responsive to stress. And you also see that in their pups, they will show differences in their response to stress as adults, and they will also, if they're female, they will show the same sorts of behaviors that their mom showed to them when they were young. And that's important because what you can do with rats is you can take the ones that would have been with moms that would not lick them very much, and you can transfer them to a mom that licks their pups a whole lot, and you find out that it's the foster mom's behavior that is what's passed on from to the next generation.
So more nurture than nature.
Well, yeah, it's hard for me to think in those terms. You know, nature and nurture, to me, I think, well, the great psychologist Donald Hebb said it best, but he said, when you talk about nature and nurture, you're really talking about, you know, it's a question as which is contributing more to the area of a rectangle? Is it the length or the width?
Mm-hmm, I see. Well, Dr. McGowan, I hope you stay in this field a long time because I have a perspective research area for you to look at in my area of work. I work in healthcare with babies, and I've seen and many people have seen this. It's not just my own perception is that babies are being handled a lot less than they used to be. They're being left alone in buckets and car seats and so forth for long periods of time now. And we're all rather alarmed and don't know what it portends for the future.
Right.
And so I'd love to have you in context of the rats that pay attention and the rats that don't. I'd love to have you be looking at those of us humans that pay attention to babies and humans that don't.
That would be a fascinating topic of research. I'd love to get involved with that in the future.
Great. It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you. You're so generous to come on the air and share your research with us, and I wish you all the best.
Well, thank you very much for your interest.
Okay, and keep warm up there.
Okay, I'll try.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've been talking with Patrick O. McGowan, a doctor doing postdoctoral research at McGill University in Canada. This is Best of Your Health with your host, Arlie Helm, on KVMR-FM 89.5, Nevada City, California.